And welcome, welcome, welcome. Good morning, good morning, good morning, dear listeners. Obviously, if you thought that, you know, the possibility of a white knuckle ride, just as Jamiroquai laid it out right there, is a possibility. Well, guys, white knuckle rides typically, you know, associated with a little bit of risk taking for some reason. And, no. Here on my Sunday morning take, it's not about, you know, taking risks. It's actually just about having a discussion about those who've taken such risks and the potential, let's call it, fallouts that might have occurred, or the almost nothings that probably would have occurred. However, welcoming you to this morning session of my Sunday morning, take. And as we always do, dear listeners, welcoming you specifically to another insightful discussion that we've got lined up for you on this morning's session that obviously highlights a very peculiar, and I like sometimes using the word very peculiar, but in this case, this is a peculiar subject matter for this morning's session that we've lined up for you in terms of looking at the world's richest company ever. Yes, there is such a thing. There is such a metric. There is such a consideration, such a measurement that took place. Someone went and researched this particular talking point, collected all the necessary data around the particular talking point, and thus, you know, positioned it specifically in a said, if we factored it into like a little bit of a metric. And this particular metric is based upon, known information, known public information, specifically of measuring all these particular companies. Now, we highlight this particular talk this morning, dear listeners, is because at the heart of everything, obviously, you've got to find a notion of the private sector actually driving the particular, if you can call it, commercial endeavor of a nation in order to achieve the said particular sort of like benefits from this trade activity, wherever this trade activity might be taking place, and primarily how this particular talking point actually manifests itself in comparison to identifying, you know, in the real life, how we wish to see such particular manifestations occur and thus also benefit a country, for example, like Namibia. Now, when you ask yourself the question of what was the richest company ever in human history? If you go and search for that particular statement today, that hypothesis today, that singular thought-provoking statement today, so anywhere else, you know, on a digital platform, there's one answer you will continuously find. So, I did not believe it because I saw it on a YouTube, there's a YouTube channel that I follow. This particular channel, they cartoonize, and I'm very suspicious of, you know, when, you know, the creators of a subject matter, the word is actually caricature, they use caricatures. Meaning they use graphics and other particular sort of like symbolisms to sort of like tell you a story of a real event. And this, in some cases, makes the viewer of said particular resource a little bit skeptical as to suspect or to think, you know, did this actually happen? But it actually did. And what they, in many cases, do is that they have to summarize the particular a talking point for you, and thus they, you know, they visualize it to you in this particular short format films or videos that they generate. So this particular resource, they had a very interesting particular subject matter. I fact checked it, the particular subject matter, and I was like, wow. And I came to many resources that actually laid it out in terms of, in comparison to the big companies of today in 2025 or 2024, this particular company itself dwarfed everyone. It dwarfed Microsoft. It dwarfed Apple. It still dwarfs Microsoft, and it still dwarfs Apple. It dwarfs Meta. It dwarfs Google. It dwarfs Nvidia. Now, in the US, they've got a particular, what do they call it? A collection of companies that they call the Big Seven in the United States. The Big Seven is traded on...
Great news! Imba just got even better. We have added brand new features to make your experience smoother, faster, and more powerful than ever before. Ready to unlock the full potential of Imba? Get all exclusive features for just 36 Namibian dollars a month, or save even more with our special subscription plans. 5% discount for 3 months subscription, 10% discount for 6 months subscription, and 25% discount for 12 months subscription. Choose the plan that works best for you and start enjoying everything Imba has to offer at an unbeatable price. Imba, where the world congregates. Download it and subscribe today.
So coming back there, dear listeners, and obviously you're here with me, Dwight, on your number one talk radio station. This is this particular segment that you're with me on from 5 a.m. up until 7 a.m. is my Sunday morning take. And just where we left off primarily was a talking point that I wanted to highlight to you based upon this morning's subject matter. So in the United States, they've got seven companies known as the Big Seven. Please, it's not known as the Magnificent Seven. That would be you confusing that label with the movie known as the Magnificent Seven. Yeah, there's such a particular... I think it's the Magnificent Eight or something like that. And these seven companies trade on the technology indices or the technology stock exchange of the United States, which is also connected internationally, known as the NASDAQ. And these seven companies are known as Apple, Google, or Google's parent company, Alphabet, Meta, Tesla, Amazon, and there's one more. It's now Nvidia that's part of this particular talking point. But these are the said known seven companies. But then, in history, in human history, overall human history of commercial activity, there are three known historic heavyweights who dwarf everything of these guys. And collectively, these three companies alone are way bigger than these seven technology companies that I just listed. So if you want to look at the total value of these companies, let me just show you in terms of the stocks, the value in stocks of the big seven companies that I just mentioned. Amazon has stocks of $2.4 trillion. Tesla has stocks of $1.1 trillion. There is Apple with stocks of, let me just properly open this. There is Apple with $3.2 trillion worth of stocks. There's Nvidia with $4.2 trillion value in stocks. And then there is Microsoft with $3.8 trillion worth of stocks. Alphabet, which is the owner of Google, $2.2 trillion, and Meta of $1.8 trillion. However, in human history, the world's three largest companies were, drum roll a little bit, the biggest was the Dutch East India Company at $10.2 trillion. This company was founded in 1602. The second largest was the Mississippi Company, which was a French-owned company. And it was founded a little bit earlier. Not earlier than the Dutch East India Company. But its peak valuation in 1720 was $8.4 trillion. And then you had the South Sea Company, which was a British-owned company, a British Crown-owned company, valued at $5.5 trillion. One of the Magnificent Seven companies today do not even come close to the 1720 level of the South Sea Company. None of them, okay, a few of them collectively come close to the Dutch East India Company's peak valuation of 1637 of $10.2 trillion. And a few also collectively come close to the valuation of the 1720 peak valuation of the Mississippi Company of $8.4 trillion. Now you will ask me, these big three companies, what did they actually trade in? Well, if we start with the big daddy of them all in human history, the Dutch East India Company was the world's first publicly traded company. It held a monopoly on the Dutch trade with Asia, dealing in valuable commodities like spices, silk, and porcelain. Throw in slavery in there as well, because human labor was also part of their portfolio offerings. The Mississippi Company was a French trading venture that triggered one of the history's first financial bubbles. It boomed on speculation over Louisiana's wealth before collapsing in 1720. And then obviously there was the South Sea Company, which was granted a monopoly on British trade with South America, and its valuation soared as it promised profits in exchange for assuming a large portion of Britain's national debt. So, when you obviously have a look at these particular things, these companies were massive. These three companies in human history were massive. Two of them obviously operated within the same particular time frame, and they had significant portfolios in terms of what they offered. But when you had to look at the discussion based upon the assessment, or not just the assessment, but just looking at what these big three companies did. If we stick to the largest one, the Dutch East India Company, and its acronym or its abbreviation is known as the VOC. It actually stands for its Dutch name, which was Verenigde Oost-Indische Compagnie, because obviously in Dutch they don't actually easily have a name for company for the Afrikaans word maatskappij. So they used compagnie, which looks like a French word, but it's obviously, you know, if you don't realize that the linguistics between Dutch, Flemish, and French are pretty close to each other, because the guys are pretty close to each other. But the name, which symbolizes the VOC indicator, stands for Verenigde Oost-Indische Compagnie. But if you had to translate that into English, technically it meant United East India Company, which it also obviously highlights. But then obviously, you know, it was easier to just say Dutch East India Company. Now, it was also known as a chartered trading company and one of the first joint stock companies in the world. And it was established on 20 March 1602 by the States General of the Netherlands, which technically amalgamated existing companies. Now, it was granted a 21-year monopoly to carry out trade activities in Asia, and the shares in the company could be purchased by any citizen of the Dutch Republic and bought and sold in open-air secondary markets, one of which became the Amsterdam Stock Exchange. Now, the company also possessed quasi-governmental powers, including the ability to wage war, imprison and execute convicts. It also negotiated treaties. It also striked its own particular coins. So what that actually meant, striking your own coin, is that you could literally create a currency that ran parallel to the national currency. A company could create this back then. They issued a considerable amount or a considerable series of coins in bronze, silver, and gold for the territories in the Far East, in the Far East between 1602 to 1799. And there literally is a representation of the coins that they used, because obviously, you know, the national currency of the Netherlands could not travel so far, so you generate a currency equivalent to the national currency of the country, and thus it has the potential to technically be traded or to float as some format of value offering being derived. Now, you've got to understand, these were companies back then, dear listeners, that literally represented also the national commercial interests of the country that the company comes from. The VOC also had the powers to establish colonies. Now, because it traded across multiple colonies and countries from both the East and the West, the VOC was sometimes considered to have been the world's first multinational corporation. Statistically, the VOC actually eclipsed all of its rivals in the Asian trade. Between 1602 and 1796, the VOC sent nearly a million Europeans to work in the Asia trade on 4,785 ships and netted for their efforts more than 2.5 million tons of Asian trade goods and slaves. By contrast, the rest of Europe actually sent 882,000. The rest of Europe combined, one country, one company, sent at least a million Europeans across the world. Europe combined sent 882,000 people from 1500 to 1795. The fleet of the English, later on the British East India Company, the VOC's nearest competitor, was a distant second to its total traffic with 2,600. 2,600 versus 4,700. And one-fifth the tonnage of goods that were carried by the VOC. The VOC also enjoyed huge profits from its spice monopoly and its slave trading activities through most of the 17th century. Now, having been established in 1602 to profit from the Malukan spice trade, the Malukan Islands, or the Maluku Islands, should I rather say, which is also now known as the Moluccas, are an archipelago in the south, in the eastern part of Indonesia. They are also located on specifically very close to the various particular sort of like trading routes where the Dutch East India Company obviously had the particular privilege of participating in. And the VOC established the capital in the port city of Jayakarta, which is today known as modern-day Jakarta, and also, you know, obviously the particular, well, if I can call it sort of like now, the capital city specifically of Indonesia. Yeah, it's Indonesia because Malaysia's capital city is Kuala Lumpur. So they established their particular capital in the port city of Jayakarta in 1619 and also changed its name to Batavia, which is now known as Jakarta. Now, over the next 200 years, the company also acquired additional ports as trading bases and safeguarded their interests by taking over surrounding territories. It remained an important trading concern and paid annual dividends that averaged to about 18% of the capital for almost 200 years. Weighed down by smuggling, corruption, and growing administrative costs in the late 18th century, the company went bankrupt and was formally dissolved in 1799. Its possessions and debt were taken over by the government of the Dutch Batavian Republic at that stage. So if you didn't know who the Batavian Republic was, that was the successor state to the Republic of the Seven United Netherlands. And it obviously was a new republic that was established in 1795 after the Batavian Revolution and it ended on 5 June 1806 with the ascension of Louis Bonaparte to the Dutch throne. If you don't know who Louis Bonaparte obviously is, it was one of the family members of Napoleon Bonaparte. So the particular impact of this company alone was far and reaching, and it was a massive particular undertaking. However, we'll quickly be taking a short musical break, dear listeners, and we'll be getting into some of the very interesting things that went down specifically under the guise and under the auspices of said particular enterprise known as the Dutch East India Company. We'll be back after this short musical break.
So these are the figurines acting out all the scenes before my eyes. I thought I knew them all by name, but they started looking much the same, and it's no surprise that I don't want to listen. I know I've won. There's nothing but rainbows. I believe in the shadows behind me. Thought I might be dropping out, but now I'm gonna work it out. I'm gonna work with me. I'm running like an Appaloosa, then I'm rolling like a rusty ship on a stormy sea. You know the people are saying strange things. Tied to the hair, cause I know you think the face is gone. I don't wanna listen too much. I'm not gonna give up on all the days I know I've won. There's nothing but blue sky. There's nothing but blue sky. Stop me now. I'm skimming like a skipping stone on a silver lake. I'll take it when the chips are down, but to play the perfect happy clown, you gotta make a mistake. And people are saying strange things, and I don't wanna listen too much, yeah. Nothing but blue sky. Blue sky. How can I tell you I know this won't be the last song? I don't wanna listen too much. Not gonna give up on all the days that I know I won.
Falling down the mountain. fun. I'm whistling like Atticus, tearing down what we attack.
Coming back there from the sound specifically of Keen, and you heard the sound, the song there of Phases, and just before that was a little bit of In Excess with the song Kiss the Dirt, or its other name. The song's other name is also known as Falling Down a Mountain. And before that, we heard a little bit of some more Jamiroquai with the song Blue Skies. So when we take a look at very super powerful, large, massive corporations that have existed in human history before, yes, we can only stand in awe. We can only go like, oh, really? Did it really look like that? Was it really this big? And ultimately, when you break things down, you also try to understand sometimes what the companies, these particular companies, were also meant to do. Now, still staying on the Dutch East India Company, because our focus is actually just about its particular size and its scale that it was involved in. Now, the Dutch East India Company was actually given a monopoly, and it was given the right to protect the country's trade. Imagine that, if a private corporation had was given the responsibility of protecting the trade of the country it comes from. It's an obviously noble particular position to have. Now, it was given the right to protect the state's trade in the Indian Ocean and to assist in the Dutch War of Independence from Spain. That's the other part of the Dutch East India, or the VOC's particular history, that we didn't cover before the musical break. Now, the Dutch War of Independence, dear listeners, was a particularly interesting thing technically, because it also helped to understand specifically what it was all about. It was also known as the 80 Years' War between 1568 to 1648, as this particular sort of like conflict was the War of the Netherlands, of the Netherlands' independence from Spain, which led to the separation of the Northern and the Southern Netherlands and to the formation of the United Provinces of the Netherlands, which were predominantly Protestant because the Spanish were Catholic. The first phase of the war also began with two unsuccessful invasions of the provinces by mercenary armies under Prince William I of the Orange, was the other name of the Dutch, and a foreign-based raids by the Guizen, who were the irregular Dutch land and sea forces. So, this was obviously a sort of like a rebel, think of it. Yeah, technically, when you think about it in like rebellion senses, rebelling against, you know, an occupier of a specific nation, obviously, and this is a discussion that happened a lot in Europe. And the Dutch were like, you know what, we've got this massive coastline, we do know how to build ships, we know what we have to do, and the best way for us to actually improve things is to trade. And how do we get to trade? Is actually when we go outside of Europe, where none of these particular monarchies and other rival countries, governments, and kings and queens are calling the shots that could literally negate any particular advantages that you wish to achieve as a newly formed nation. So obviously the VOC was established, and the VOC was given strict and literally uncontrolled access to international trade for the Netherlands, as long as it benefited the Netherlands. Now, the company prospered through most of the 17th century as this instrument of the powerful Dutch commercial empire in the East Indies, which is today known as Indonesia. And it was actually, as we heard a little bit earlier before the musical break, in 1799. Now, here's an interesting fact. The Dutch government granted the company a trade monopoly in the waters between the Cape of Good Hope. So literally, if you did not know, Jan van Riebeek and his wife, Maria de la Qualerie, were representatives of the Dutch East India Company. Because the company was given the right to a trade monopoly between the Cape of Good Hope, and guess where, guys? Which is at the southern tip of Africa, the Cape of Good Hope. Because the Cape of Good Hope is not Cape Town. It's literally slightly lower from Cape Town. You know, you have to move from Cape Town. It's a little bit lower. it was given that particular monopoly to the Atlantic Ocean in a straight line from there to across the Atlantic Ocean to the Straits of Magellan. If you don't know where the Straits of Magellan is, the Straits of Magellan is that little passage below South America. If you're sailing from the Atlantic Ocean around South America to get to the Pacific Ocean on the other end. Now that's the Straits of Magellan because it was previously discovered by another Spanish adventurer known as Magellan. He also suffered a lot of particular ache on that journey because they literally sailed. They experienced one of the worst particular experiences that any sailor in human history can experience, was that they sailed into the Pacific Ocean. And the reason why the Pacific Ocean was given its name the Pacific, which translates to a description of a pacified ocean, because if you're sailing in the Atlantic is a pretty volatile ocean to sail in. When Magellan and his fleet of ships sailed into the Pacific around the southern tip of South America, they sailed on one of the most unfortunate things, and this happens a lot in the Pacific Ocean area, is that they sailed into a zone that had no wind. And it is one of the downsides of the Pacific Ocean because of its size. It's our largest ocean. These guys sailed into a dead zone which had no wind. They were floating about for weeks. His sailors were suffering from dehydration, from malnutrition, because they were going too slow and they hoped that they could reach some sort of land in terms of actually being able to get fresh water and some food supplies. Remember, the last time they had anything was when they stopped off in South America. They obviously had eaten through all their rations and all their stuff when they sailed out into the Pacific Ocean. Now, getting you back to the East India Company discussion was that, as you can obviously see, the whole of the South Atlantic had been given as a monopoly, a trade monopoly discussion to the East India Company, the Dutch East India Company. It should not be confused with the British East India Company. Just so that you guys know, the VOC and the British East India Company, they had a different abbreviation. They were the EIC, the British one. There were two different companies, and they were actually, at their height of discussions in the 1700s, they were actually competing with each other. Just to let you know. Now, this company, the VOC, was also given the right to conclude national treaties with the governments at the time that were found in not just in Africa, but also in South America and also in other parts of the world, specifically as their aim was to get to Asia. And they also had the right to build forts and to maintain the armed forces, and also to carry on administrative functions through officials who were required to take an oath of loyalty to the Dutch government, obviously so as to not break away and thus become hostile towards the Dutch government itself. Now, under the administration of the powerful or the forceful governors general, most notably, for example, one known as Jan Pieter Zoon Koen, who was a Dutch governor general between 1618 to 1623, and Anthony van Diemen, who was a Dutch governor general from 1636 to 1645, the company was able to defeat the British fleet and largely replace the Portuguese in the East Indies. Now, this obviously shows you a particular volatile time back then, when trade was a highly protected resource. Which is also one of the particular reasons as to understand in the modern day context of trade why a country's coastline is essential to helping with trade. You cannot go wrong. If you've got a coastline, your country will prosper. It will prosper. When you look at the particular dimensions in terms of obviously what took place, is that in many cases, these countries realized from what happened in, and it was primarily because of Marco Polo once again, that what Marco Polo brought back from the China that he encountered, remember, he literally met the descendants of Genghis Khan. He met Kublai Khan. I'm saying Genghis's name incorrect. It's actually Genghis or Genghis Khan. Marco Polo literally met the descendant, the grandson or the great-grandson of the Mongol emperor, Mongolian emperor, Genghis Khan. He met Kublai Khan. He was in the court of Kublai Khan, who was a Chinese emperor at the time. And Kublai Khan liked the man. Now, obviously, Marco Polo, you know, came with, it was just him, his uncle, and two other Italians. And all they could do was just trade the small amounts of trade that they could. And then Marco Polo and his uncle obviously had to live there a little bit longer than what they expected because of Kublai Khan's particular interest in Marco Polo in terms of the stories and, you know, what he was explaining about Venice. Yeah, Marco Polo was from Venice, yeah. But since our discussion is not about Marco Polo, it's technically about the Dutch East India Company, the world's largest known company by assets and value, was that if you had access to something that other Europeans at that time in the 1600s and the 1500s did not have access to, it was considered a state secret. Well, for anyone that recently watched the TV show known as Shogun, that played earlier this year specifically, that TV show took place slightly earlier than the establishment of the Dutch East India Company. Reason being is that in the 1500s, the Spanish and obviously the Portuguese were already sailing about trying to discover, you know, various other particular international resources out there, which they then can obviously plunder and bring back to their home nations. If you guys did not know, remember the particular interesting discussion I had about the establishment of Sao Tome and Principe, which was established, which was an supposedly uninhabited archipelago just here off the coast of Nigeria. And it was established firstly as a particular production hub for sugarcane and other particular agricultural products. And then it became a transition point or transfer point from Africa to South America for plantations and the particular slave trade that obviously also started taking hold at that particular time. Now, in 1619, the Dutch East India Company renamed Jakarta Batavia, now known as Jakarta, and used it as a base to conquer Java and the other outer islands specifically, which is now known as modern-day Indonesia. By the late 17th century, the company had declined as a trading and sea power and had become more and more involved in the affairs of Java. Now, Java was the old name of Indonesia, if you guys also don't know. And it's also the particular name that is colloquially sometimes used for coffee. Well, I use that name because Java is, well, one of the particular spots where they technically also found coffee itself. Now, by the 18th century, the company had changed from a commercial shipping enterprise to a loose territorial organization that was interested in the agricultural produce of the Indonesian archipelago. Towards the end of the 18th century, The company became corrupt and started literally being, you know, becoming seriously in debt, with the Dutch government eventually revoking the company's charter, and in 1799 took over its debts and its possessions. Now, there are interesting things, obviously, that spanned out or that came into existence because of this particular company. For example, if you go to Cape Town, if any of you have been in Cape Town recently, there's a whole bunch of particularly interesting buildings that you would find in the city center of Cape Town, which was the original sort of like area that was developed by the Dutch in order for their particular activities. And one of them was a very interesting building known as the Slave Lodge. Was built in 1679 in Cape Town, South Africa, which once housed the slaves who worked for the Dutch East India Company in the Cape of Good Hope vicinity, specifically of South Africa. So if you did not know, there are obviously certain particular indicators also present here on the African continent. Now, before we continue, dear listeners, we'll be taking a short musical break, and after the musical break, we'll be coming back, heading into the second half of this morning's program of My Sunday Morning Take, and you're in my company, Dwight, from 5 a.m. up until 7 a.m. Let's see each other on the other side of this musical break.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person who doesn't have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to do.
Be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past.
Mm.
And it's not something Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
The eye.
You're now listening to My Sunday Morning Take, the show where we dive into everything history, everything geography, a little bit of science, and everything else in between to help you make sense of how it works around you. From 5 a.m. to 7 a.m. every Sunday. Imba het nou nog beter geword. Ons het splinternuwe funksies bygevoeg om jou ervaring vinniger, beter en kragtiger te maak as ooit tevore. As jy gereed om die volle potensiaal van Imba te geniet, kry alle eksklusiewe funksies vir slegs $36 per maand of spaar selfs meer met ons spesiale intekenplanne. 5% afslag vir 'n 3 maande intekening, 10% afslag vir 'n 6 maande intekening en 25% afslag vir 'n 12 maande intekening. Kies die beste plan vir jou werk en geniet al die voordele wat Imba bied teen 'n onverbeterlike prys. Imba, waar die wêreld saamkom, laai dit af en teken vandag aan.
Something's
Swallow for the rest of your life. You've been looking for someone to believe in, to love you until your eyes run dry.
Love on a night without.
come back there from the sound specifically of Razor Light with the song Wire to Wire. A little bit earlier, you heard the, if you could call it sort of like the timeless voice of George Michael, primarily with the song Father Figure. And it does sort of like bring us up past the midway point at about, you know, 8 minutes past six. And if you're just switching on, good morning. Welcome to this morning session, the Sunday morning session of my Sunday morning take here on your number one talk radio station. Wherever you're listening to us from, ultimately, you're in our company from 5 a.m. up until 7 a.m. Now, things obviously in terms of the, you know, some of the talking points that obviously stemmed from our discussion just before the midway point itself highlights to you in terms of the presence of this company. This obviously being the Verenigde Nederlandse Oost-Indische Compagnie, but it actually had another particular name. Its full name was the Verenigde Nederlandse Geotrooierde Oost-Indische Compagnie. I mean, guys, I'm sorry, you know, the Dutch is not Dutching with Afrikaans, you know, in some cases. So sometimes you have to try and understand what the Dutch are saying specifically in that scenario. But yeah. Now, the company obviously conducted their operations from their hometown. The first letter of the hometown of the chamber, obviously they conducted the operation itself. Now, when you had to look at the history of this specific enterprise itself, which is now known as the world's largest enterprise at any particular point in human history, and if you ever had to see what the first stock exchange that this company actually engaged in or was listed on actually looked at. So just to give you guys an indicator, if you guys have ever seen those Wall Street stock exchange interactions where you've got all those traders that were just shouting and making noise and sounds and stuff like that, imagine that in real life without the computers, and primarily that it was just a bunch of people just there. They're just there. Now, I know there's a lot of you Namibians that don't even know where the Namibian Stock Exchange is based or where it actually is or how many traders there are actually all are participating in trades of this thing, but I'll tell you today, it's nowhere close to the size of the things that even the Johannesburg Stock Exchange for that matter is, you know, literally out of our particular mindset in terms of visualizing itself. Now, the earliest stock exchange description obviously was a scenario that obviously took place back in Europe at that particular time in 1602-ish, thereabout. But the whole discussion, as mentioned a little bit earlier in our talk, was that the Dutch East India Company was set up in order to achieve commercial growth for the newly formed Dutch Republic, or the Netherlands, or the United Netherlands provinces scenario. Because before the Dutch Revolt, which began in 1566 to 1568, the Flemish city of Antwerp, which is today found in Belgium, had played an important role as a distribution center in Northern Europe, because Antwerp has old trade routes. And if you guys don't know, Antwerp is also one of the old diamond trade centers or hubs in the world. It's Antwerp, it's Moscow, and it's someone else. I think it's London and New York, for that matter. So you guys can obviously see that there are specific historic cities that play historical trade roles even till this day. So after 1591, the Portuguese used an international syndicate of the German Fugger family and the Welser family. The German Fugger family was a German family that was historically a prominent group of European bankers. And there's an interesting discussion around these bankers. But they weren't the only bankers, because you had the Italians as well. But obviously, if you understand what happened, you know, in that space in Europe, is that the Italy today is not the Italy of then that you need to think of, because each one was a principality. But there was a very influential Italian family that actually helped form the modern day banking system that you need to think of in terms of, you know, obviously what we see today. Now, the Fugger family itself, they were a prominent banking family, and they were members of the mercantile patriciate of Augsburg, which is southern Germany. There was also the Welser family, specifically that the Portuguese had made use of. They were also a prominent banking and merchant family from Germany as well. They were also from Augsburg and from the other, from the neighboring city close to Augsburg and today known as Munich, known as Nuremberg, because Nuremberg is also in southern Germany. And these particular families were the bankers of a specific royal family in Europe known as the Habsburgs. The Habsburgs were the owners of what we now know today as the Netherlands. They were the, you know, the monarchs at that stage. So the Portuguese also made use of Spanish and Italian bank.
Great news. Imba just got even better. We have added brand new features to make your experience smoother, faster, and more powerful than ever before. Ready to unlock the full potential of Imba? Get all exclusive features for just 36 Namibian dollars a month, or save even more with our special subscription plans. 5% discount for 3 months subscription, 10% discount for 6 months subscription, and 25% discount for 12 months subscription. Choose the plan that works best for you and start enjoying everything Imba has to offer at an unbeatable price. Imba, where the world congregates. Download it and subscribe today.
Definitely where the world congregates, dear listeners. And obviously, if you wish to find out where you can look up more about Imba, just go to your beloved particular sort of like mobile device platform known as either Google Play Store or the Apple Store itself, and just go and search for the Imba application right there. Where we left off just before the ad break, dear listeners, because you're here on my Sunday Morning Take with me, Dwight, from 5 to 7. And the particular interesting thing was that, since you can obviously see what was at play, because the Habsburgs were sort of like the existing government at that stage over the Netherlands, and the Netherlands and various particular entities did not like the way they were technically being governed. Something similar to, you know, our own particular independence discussions, except for the other particular independence discussions of Namibia, which happened a little bit earlier, 100 years later or 100 years ago. But when you had to look at the situation happening with how the Dutch East India Company came about, was that specifically everything had to flow through the German city of Hamburg as the staple port to distribute the goods from. So obviously, this made things a little bit trickier for the Dutch, because they were wondering to themselves, but we also have a coastline. Why would these supply ships sail past us? So it cut off the Dutch merchants out of the trade discussion, and at the same time, the Portuguese trade system was unable to increase supply to satisfy growing demand. And in particular, the demand for pepper, spice, guys. You guys would not believe how important and crucial spices were back then. The whole reason, in many cases, a lot of colonization took place from other parts of Europe was because of spice. The Europeans wanted pepper. They wanted turmeric. They wanted cayenne pepper. You know, that one we call red pepper, chili pepper or whatever, but cayenne pepper. They wanted rosemary. They wanted thyme. They wanted, what was the other one's name? Parsley. All these various spices and herbs that cannot grow in Europe. That's what the Europeans wanted. That's what they made technically in modern day terms, measured back then based upon the amount of quantities that they actually transported and traded in, they made billions from pepper. I'll say it again. They made billions from pepper and curry powder and turmeric. And what's that other thing that comes, that other spice that comes from Asia? Man, why do I only know now the Afrikaans one? I almost said camel. in Afrikaans, we call it kaneel. Cinnamon. Cinnamon. They made billions from trading in cinnamon, guys. Cinnamon. So obviously, the Europeans realized, because all of this actually started out of after Marco Polo, if you guys don't know, like I referenced earlier, was that there was a major boost specifically in textiles, meaning fabrics, the trade of fabrics and other particular fabric-based products, and then obviously the spices for food. Because here's the thing, guys. The Europeans back then did not have these particular plants that can actually grow in their climate to provide them with the similar products. So when this was discovered, these spices, these specific food-based products, it improved the cuisine greatly for many Europeans. And then you obviously also have the other particular products like oranges and lemons and tangerines and peaches. These products, these other particular agricultural products that are tropical-based products. Remember, Europe is not tropical. Europe is not tropical. So just imagine to yourself, 400 to 500 years back, people did not know what an orange was. Even though they knew that, you know, there was the color orange, but they did not know what an orange was. And now suddenly, you now get introduced to things like an orange, or an apple, or a lemon. Or you get introduced to something like a watermelon. You know, the products, you know, agricultural products that have vitamin C in it, which is essential specifically to sailors of the time. Because the biggest concern, the biggest health concern that the sailors of the time back in the 1500s and the 1600s faced, if you guys don't know it, it was known as scurvy. So what was scurvy? Scurvy was the vitamin C deficiency disease. Scurvy happened, when scurvy happens to a human, your teeth start falling out, your hair starts falling out, your skin starts changing color, you know, you become a weird color. It's similar to that other disease where it indicates that your liver is, or one of your particular internal organs is busy poisoning your body. I think it's your appendix, but there's also like a liver and kidney failure that also give a particular indication to people, specifically on your skin colorization, when you know your kidneys and your liver have failed and it's busy poisoning you because your body has no filtering system anymore. So these particular products, these particular agricultural products, were essential at that time for the sailors of these particular enterprises to technically operate and flourish. So, in 1580, the Portuguese crown was united in a personal union with the Spanish crown. So obviously, it then later on became known as the Iberian crown, with which the Dutch Republic was at war. So the Portuguese Empire thus became an appropriate target for the Dutch military incursions as well. So obviously at that stage, the conflict was still ongoing. Now, these factors motivated Dutch merchants to enter the intercontinental spice trade themselves. Further on, a number of Dutch merchants and explorers, such as Jan Huygen van Linschoten, and Cornelius de Houtman obtained first-hand knowledge of the secret Portuguese trade routes and practices that provided further opportunity for the Dutch to enter the trade. So, what was at play? Well, if you guys remember a little bit earlier this year when I had one of the My Sunday Morning Take discussions based upon the archaeological find right outside Oranjemund, which you don't see much of in local media. The archaeological find was because of the Bom Jesus that is kept in a museum there in Oranjemund. The Bom Jesus has literally billions of dollars worth of gold and other particular artifacts in its hull because it has to stay right there. Either you can't move it easily. And it also became a national treasure because it's so valuable. And the Portuguese literally donated it to us because the Portuguese government, guys, has a right to claim the property, the ship, and its contents because it was a government ship. If it was a private, let's say a private company's asset, the country of origin for the company could not claim the asset back because it was a private company's asset. But the Bom Jesus was a government ship of the Portuguese government at the time, which was a monarchy. So the Bom Jesus is now Namibian property. And at the heart of that, obviously, was that you've got to look at when the Bom Jesus obviously, beached in Namibia at the time. And they were on their way to basically Asia, around the southern tip of Africa, going to Asia. So you can obviously see when the Dutch East India Company came into operation, which was 1602, versus when the Bom Jesus technically beached here in Namibia, was that the Portuguese were well established at this intercontinental trade discussion. And the Portuguese were technically at that stage the trailblazers in exploration and discovery around the world. So this obviously must cite to you specifically what the Dutch saw in this discussion as going like, oh, okay, so Portugal, you and the Spanish, you guys are only powerful because you've got access to all these particular trade markets because of your port facilities. Lo and behold, dear listeners, stepping specifically into the discussion, the stage was set for the Dutch expeditions to the Indonesian islands, specifically beginning with James Lancaster, an Englishman, obviously, as you hear there. He was a privateer. Now, privateers, guys, were the first indications of the modern-day pirate that you would hear sometimes. For example, any of you that were fans of the Jack Sparrow-induced franchise from Disney Entertainment, which was obviously the Pirates of the Caribbean franchise of movies, is that the pirates were not pirates first. The pirates were literally private ship owners who were paid by, for example, in the discussion of the British, they were paid by the British Crown to harass enemies of the state. So at the stage when all this took place, because in 1591, technically, this would be the particular period when Elizabeth I of England was in charge of being there. And technically, at that stage was also the great naval battle between the Spanish Armada, which was ambushed by the British Navy. The British Navy was not actually a navy. It was a navy that consisted of privateers and a very small, actually standing English navy. And it was obviously led by Francis Drake, the supposed, very well-known naval commander at the time. And they destroyed the very large, very powerful Spanish Armada. And even the British historians will tell you that the actual aim as to why the Spanish Armada actually lost that naval battle was because their actual goal was not to have a fight on the sea. Their actual goal was to sail from Portugal to the Netherlands to go pick up the Spanish army that was based in the Netherlands, which actually feeds to you the specific setting in terms of what was actually at play. Because you would ask yourself the first question of, now why is my army not in Spain, but in the Netherlands? Well, this particularly sets the scene. So, obviously the British did a massive favor to the to the Dutch at the time. They obliterated the Spanish Navy at the time, which trapped the Spanish army in the Netherlands, while the Dutch were obviously, you know, fighting for their own independence, in inverted commas, because they've had multiple independences and change of governments in between. So James Lancaster was a privateer in 1591, became the first particular sort of like Dutch explorer, Dutch representative. Then it was followed by Cornelius de Houtman in 1595 and in 1598, and then by Jacob van Neck in 1598, and Lancaster again in 1601, among others. Now, during the four-ship exploratory expedition by Frederick de Houtman, in 1595 to Banten. Now, Banten is also a specific zone in Indonesia. It is a port town near the western end of Java, Indonesia, and it had a secure harbor at the mouth of the Banten River, which was, you could sail up with your ship at that stage. So, the Banten was the main pepper port of West Java. So, as you can see, pepper was a huge commodity that was traded. And the crew from Frederick de Houtman clashed with the Portuguese and indigenous Javanese at that particular place. Now, Houtman's expedition then sailed east along the north coast of Java, losing 12 crew members to a Javanese attack at Sidayu and killing a local ruler in Madura. Half the crew were lost because before the expedition made it back to the Netherlands in 1596, but with enough spice to make a considerable profit. In 1598, an increasing number of fleets were sent out by competing merchant groups from around the Netherlands. Some fleets were lost, but most were successful, with some voyages producing high profits. In 1598 alone, a fleet of 8 ships under Jacob van Neck were the first Dutch fleet to reach the Spice Islands of Maluku, also known as the Moluccas, cutting out the Javanese middlemen, and the ships returned to Europe in 1599 and 1600, and the expedition made a 400% profit. In 1600, the Dutch then joined forces with the Muslim Hituis on Ambon Island in an anti-Portuguese alliance. So the Ambon Islands were also part of that cluster of Indonesian islands. And if you guys don't know, Indonesia consists of a ton of islands. Yes, Indonesia consists of a ton of islands. It's not like Namibia where you've got one main particular land mass which identifies the central hub of said particular, you know, identity of the country. No, Indonesia is, I think it's more than 200 islands. Speak under correction, Indonesia has more than 200 islands alone. And each island, Indonesia is also, after China and India, and separate from Japan, it is Asia's other 100 million plus population. It has 160 million people. And each of those islands alone has a different ethnic group, or what we call here in Africa a tribe, because for some reason we show up here with the word tribe, but it's actually supposed to be ethnicity. A different ethnicity with their own language and their own cultural practices and their own cultural identity on each of those islands. They're also one of the countries in the world with the highest density of fauna and flora diversity, so meaning animals, insect life, plant life, bird life, you name it, across all those islands together. So, and it makes them also, they also have one of the largest presences of conservation areas and conservation parks. I mean, many of you Namibians that have gone to, what's that island's name? Bali? I think Bali is Indonesia, yeah. You guys obviously would have seen the particular, you know, there is a conservation area right close to Bali, just to let you know, that ultimately speaks towards the indication of, you know, just how diverse this particular discussion. Yeah, Bali is part of Indonesia. It's a province of Indonesia. So, getting back to where we left off specifically with our discussion was that the Ambon Island, obviously it was the place for this particular anti-Portuguese alliance between locals of this area of Indonesia and the Dutch forces. And in return for which the Dutch were given the sole right to purchase spices from another territory or another local group there, the Hitu. So the Dutch control of Ambon was achieved when the Portuguese surrendered their fort in Ambon to the Dutch Hituese alliance. And in 1613, the Dutch expelled the Portuguese from their Solor fort, but a subsequent Portuguese attack led to a second change of hands. Following this particular second reoccupation, the Dutch again captured Solor in 1636. Now, east of Solor, on the island of Timor, which is now an independent state itself, Dutch advances were also halted by an autonomous and powerful group of Portuguese Eurasians that were called the Topazes. So the Topazes were a group of people led by two powerful families, the Da Costa and the Hornei, that resided in this particular part of Timor, of Asia. And the Da Costa families were descendants of Portuguese Jewish merchants, and the Hornei were Dutch. So the Dutch came up against known mixed race Asians that were already settled on this island. Well, I can't say mixed race, because mixed race does not sound right. mixed ethnicity, peoples there in Indonesia, or not in Indonesia, but they're close to Indonesia, on this particular platform. Now, the Dutch remained in control of the sandalwood trade in this regard, and the resistance that was offered by the Topazes lasted throughout the 17th and the 18th centuries, which caused Portuguese Timor to remain under Portuguese sphere of control. This particular indication obviously meant, dear listeners, that when the Dutch East India Company actually came into formation by 1602, you know, there was already a substantial amount of conflict that was present between the Netherlands and specifically a whole lot of other nations in Europe. But predominantly, these were the Catholic nations. If you guys don't know, some of the particular sort of like, if we could call it religious violence that you sometimes see today that come through from various particular backgrounds across the world was something that Europe also went through. Even though modern day Europe now tries to be this sort of like beacon of morality, logical thinking, scientific approaches and the likes, there was a time they were also a proponent of religious violence. Because the whole reason why the Netherlands was occupied by the Spanish and Portuguese, and why they were also sidestepped in trade by the Portuguese, was because of religion. The Dutch, what is that church that comes from them? I think it's the Rhenish Mission? The Rhenish Missions? Came from the Netherlands and some of the Germanic principalities itself. And obviously, you've got that other particular church here in Namibia, which is known as the Dutch Reformed Church. Came from them as well. And yes, you also have to look at the, for example, like the Lutheran Church as well. Because if you don't know who Martin Luther was, Martin Luther was a former Catholic priest, and he did not like the way in terms of how things were done when he was in existence. And Martin Luther lived in the specific time era and time frame when the Dutch East India Company started taking formation. So, the formative years of the Dutch East India Company obviously was some of the interesting particular talking points, because at the time, it was customary for a company to be funded for the duration of a single voyage, meaning you had these particular companies that came into existence for a specific reason. It forms into the statement that I also made the other particular time when Helmut and I on the home run, where we looked at the various dimensions of the creative sector in Namibia, that when we look at the creative sector, Namibia's particular business law and company law has to be flexible in terms of that the trend that is being set around the world, and this comes from Japan to all manner of countries around the world, is that most of them follow the same template. When a movie is produced, it is produced as a company, because the movie is a project. The movie needs to make its money. The movie has its own project manager, which is the director. The movie has its own particular employees, which are the crew, the production crew, and the cast, meaning the talent, which are the actors. And then the particular movie itself owns its own intellectual property, but the intellectual property is also owned by the production company or production companies that are producing the movie. So it's almost like a double fold intellectual or legal protection mechanism. Now, when you look at the scenario of a movie has its own finance manager, has its own accountant, has its own HR particular policy situation, has its own particular, the project manager could be considered like the CEO of the movie, which is the director, and various other particular similarities like what you would find in the modern day company setup. Now, that particular indication is something that obviously was also associated to what international trade at that stage in the 1600s and 1500s was based upon. A company is set up just for this expedition, let's say to Java in Indonesia, just to go and buy pepper, bring the pepper back, and sell the pepper in the Netherlands. So, as mentioned, it was customary for a company to be funded only for the duration of a single voyage and to be liquidated upon the return of the fleet. Investment in these expeditions was a very high-risk venture because of the usual dangers of piracy, disease, and shipwreck, and because the interplay of inelastic demand and relatively elastic supply of spices could make prices tumble. Now, this also meant that it could ruin the prospects of profitability. Now, to manage such risk, the forming of a cartel to control supply would seem logic. It's the only logic that you could get to. So, in 1600, the English were the first to adopt this approach by bundling their resources into a monopoly enterprise, which was known as the English East India Company. Thereby, they started threatening the Dutch competitors with ruin. So, by 1602, the Dutch government followed suit, sponsoring the creation of a single United East Indies Company that was also granted monopoly over the Asian trade. For a time in the 17th century, it was able to monopolize the trade in nutmeg, mace, and cloves, and also to sell these spices across European kingdoms and to the Emperor Akbar the Great's Mughal Empire at 14 to 17 times the price it paid for in Indonesia. Now, while the Dutch profits soared, the local economy of the Spice Islands were destroyed because, as a monopoly buyer, the VOC forced the prices paid to the local producers in the Spice Islands down to low levels. With a capital of about 6.4 million guilders. If you don't know what a guilder is, guys, it was a specific Dutch coin, originally shortened from the Middle Age German Gulden Pfennig. This was a specific term, ultimately, because it was a gold coin that was used. The new company's charter empowered it to build forts, maintain armies, and to conclude treaties with Asian rulers. It provided for a venture that continued for 21 years with a financial accounting only at the end of each 10-year period. So they would only account for what they were doing. You know, imagine this, guys. If one of our state-owned enterprises decided to report what they were doing every 10 years. Think about the madness in that situation. But yeah. So by February of 1603, the company then seized Santa Catarina, which was a 1,500-ton Portuguese merchant ship. The actual name was a carack. And it was seized off the coast of the Malay Peninsula in Malaysia. That same year, a joint Dutch-English force captured another Portuguese carack off of Macau, which is in modern-day China. The proceeds from the sale of the cargo and of the two vessels was equivalent to more than 50% of the VOC's original subscription capital. And remember, this happened at the ICs. I mean, if there were enemies of the state back then in the 1600s, you guys could literally, you know, confiscate each other's assets and then sell it off. That's why you guys see that particular discussion taking place right now today, 3 years after the Ukraine conflict, as the former president of the United States, Joe Biden, and his particular administration wanted to give the financial assets of Russia, which are seized and under sanction in the United States financial market, they wanted to hand that over to the Ukrainians. But if you do that, it's one of the considerations of an act of war, because then the Americans would be declaring that they are in conflict against the Russians. Now, that's also the same particular discussion that the EU was discussing just last week and the week before. Do they hand over the financial assets that are under sanction and had been seized in the European financial markets to the Ukrainians? Now, the Europeans are constantly going like, yes, we will do this, yes, we will do this. And every time they are warned that the moment they do something like that, they are declaring war against Russia. So if you guys just need to understand the particular legal basis on that particular consideration, it is based upon a precedent of what used to happen when two states were at war in a European context, because much of the global and international law is technically European law, is that when you declare someone an enemy of the state or another country an enemy of your state, one of the first particular things that always gets seized, sold off, confiscated and sold off, or captured, confiscated, seized and sold, are assets of the other state, which is considered to be the enemy of said particular state doing the said capturing and confiscation. So, at the heart of that scenario, the discussion is born on, okay, how do you view this particular discussion in terms of the Dutch East India Company's particular formation back then and what it technically represents? And what it meant was that the Dutch East India Company was also allowed, literally, to wage war. Now, in 1603, the first permanent Dutch trading post in Indonesia was established in Banten, West Java. And in 1611, another was established in Jayakarta, which later on became Batavia, and then later on became the capital, what we know today as Jakarta. In 1610, the VOC established the post of the Governor General to more firmly control the affairs in Asia and to advise and control the risk of despotic, yes, despotic general governors general. A council of the Indies, also translated from the Dutch sentence or statement of the similar name, Raad van Indië, was created. Now, the governor general effectively became the main administrator of the VOC's activities in Asia. Now, the Heeren, is this 15, no, 17. The Heeren 15, the Heeren 17, which was a body of 17 shareholders representing different chambers, continued to officially have overall control over this particular endeavor. So the VOC headquarters were located in Ambon during the 10 years of the first three governors general from 1610 to 1619, but it was not a satisfactory location as well. Why? Because although it was at the center of the spice production areas where the Dutch East India Company was sourcing these raw products from, a location in the west of the archipelago was then sought. Now, the Straits of Malacca were strategic but became dangerous following the Portuguese conquests, and the first permanent VOC settlement in Banten was controlled by a powerful local ruler, and it was subject to stiff competition from Chinese and English traders in the areas. So, in 1604, a second English East India Company voyage commanded by Henry Middleton reached the islands of Ternate, Tidore, Ambon, and Banda. In Banda, they encountered severe VOC hostility. Remember, this is the British East India Company coming into contact with the Dutch East India Company. This then later on sparked the Anglo-Dutch competition for access to spices. It was also one of the particular reasons as to why the British... No, that was in the 1700s. We're still in the 1600s. But still, it was one of the reasons in terms of why the British and the Dutch started having animosity towards each other. But still, in Banda, they encountered this hostility specifically around the access to spices discussion, from 1611 to 1617, the English established trading posts at Sugadana, which is southwest Kalimantan, Makassar, Jayakarta, and Jepara in Java, and in Aceh, Pariaman, and Jambi in Sumatra. All of them are still in Indonesia, remember this, which also further threatened Dutch ambitions for monopoly on East Indies trade. In 1620, diplomatic agreements in Europe ushered in a period of collaboration between the Dutch and the English in the spice trade discussion. This ended with the notorious Amboina massacre, where 10 Englishmen were arrested, tried, and beheaded for conspiracy against the Dutch government. So what happened actually at the Amboina massacre? This was a 1623 torture and execution on the Ambon island of 21 men, including 10 in the service of the English East India Company, as well as Japanese and Portuguese traders, and one Portuguese man, by agents of the Dutch East India Company. And they were primarily accused, yeah, and this usually happened a lot, guys. These guys were primarily accused of treason. Now, it was the result of an intense rivalry between the East India Companies of England and the Dutch in the spice trade, and remained a source of tension between the two nations until the late 17th century. So you can obviously see that the animosity was high, because it was one of the reasons also as to why the British decided to go and take over Cape Town, or the Cape of Good Hope, in the 1700s, because of this tension between the British and the Dutch. So, although this caused outrage in Europe and a diplomatic crisis, the English quietly withdrew from most of their Indonesian activities, except for trading in Banten, and focused on other Asian interests. So, this obviously led to the particular growth spurt that the Dutch East India Company then enjoyed, because in 1619, Jan Pieter Zoon Koen was then appointed as the Governor General of the VOC, and he saw the possibility of the VOC becoming an Asian power, both politically and economically. And on 30 May 1619, Koen, backed by a force of 19 ships, stormed Jayakarta, which is today known as Jakarta, driving out the Bantan forces, and from the ashes established Batavia as the VOC headquarters. And in the 1620s, almost the entire native population of the Banda Islands were driven away, starved to death or killed in an attempt to replace them with Dutch plantations and Dutch industrial activity. Now, these plantations were used to grow the nutmeg for export. Coon then hoped to settle large numbers of Dutch colonists in the East Indies, but the implementation of this policy was never materialized, mainly because very few Dutch were willing to emigrate to Asia. Now, on that note, dear listeners, it actually does bring us up to the end of our discussion as well, but we have a short window of time in terms of just slipping in one specific musical break. After that, we'll be reaching the end of this morning's discussion here on your number one talk station, and specifically of my Sunday morning take for the Sunday edition. And we'll be saying our goodbyes at the top of the hour. On that note, see you right after this musical break.
200 grams of Champion Hunter's Polony. Save big. Add, you save.
Think about the old days, babe. You're always on my mind. I know it ain't like I remember. I guess my memories run wild. Like when we went to see Bob Dylan. We danced to Desolation Row. But I don't live here anymore. I got no place to go. Burning like a heart, I'm gonna walk through every doorway. I can't stop. I need some time. I need control. I need your love. I wanna find out. An ocean. My memories like waves. Is life just dying in slow motion? Or getting stronger every day. I never took our love for granted. You never left me wanting more. But you never recognized me, baby. I don't live here anymore. Like a heart, I'm gonna walk through every doorway. I can stop. I need some time. I need control. I need your love. I wanna find out everything I need to know. I'm gonna say everything that I need to say. Although you've taken everything I need away. I'm gonna take it to the place I need to go. We're all just walking through this darkness on our own. Feeling like a heart, I'm gonna walk through every doorway. I need some time, I need control, I need to love. I wanna find out everything I need to know. I'm gonna say everything that
coming back there from the sound specifically of the War Against Drugs with the song there of I Don't Live Here Anymore. And that brings us up to about 5 minutes past the top of the hour of 7 a.m. And if you've just woken up, unfortunately, it's good morning to you and it's goodbye from me. And it's kindly stay tuned for the rest of the programming here on your number one talk radio station, that being Eagle FM, as we obviously bring you your relaxing Sunday programming, as we always do specifically here on Eagle FM. And stay tuned and in our company all the way through this particular interesting Sunday. I call it an interesting Sunday, guys, because the weather of yesterday was just like, it started weirdly, it went nicely, and then it just opened up and there are no clouds in the sky anymore. Wherever you find yourself, and you and the rain probably, you know, I am envious, but enjoy it because it was a pretty nice yesterday. And let's see each other again during the course of the week with the home run that we've obviously got scheduled for you and other particular developments and discussions. And stay tuned as we end off on a little bit of Santana on the other side of this.
Creature void of form, been so afraid of everything. I need a chance to be reborn. I never wanted anything that someone had to give.
Bargain Hunters, You Save has slashed prices on groceries, treats, fresh fruit, and veggies. 2 kilos Real Good frozen mixed chicken portions, just 89.99 Namibian dollars. 5 kilos Champion Square maize meal, just 56.99 Namibian dollars. And pay just 19.99 for each of the following: 700 milliliter crystal gold tomato sauce, 1 liter clover full cream milk,